Thank you very much,
Linton, for that kind introduction, and good afternoon, one and all. Yeah, sometimes up, sometimes down, and of course sometimes steady, right? Well, ladies and gentlemen, the last time I gave a speech in London was January of 2008. Quite a lot happened later that year, so I'm hoping that this is not a portent of anything remotely resembling a repeat, and I'm sure you're all hoping the same. Later that year, a sequence of financial events saw the global financial system teeter on the brink. And that was followed very quickly by a very sharp global economic slowdown in the closing months of 2008 and the early part of 2009. For the global economy, a recovery in economic activity commenced shortly thereafter. And it's turned out, contrary to most people's expectations a couple of years ago, to be quite a robust one overall. Real GDP for the global economy expanded by 5% in 2010, according to the latest IMF figures, which is well above the medium-term trend rate of just under 4%. The most recent published forecasts by the fund have growth likely to run at 4.5% in the current year, which is still a number well above its trend rate of growth. But the pattern of that growth has been quite uneven so far. Here in this part of the world, recovery is proving to be, of course, rather protracted and difficult. And yet in the Asian region, the recovery has been a V-shaped one, of classic size and speed. And indeed, concerns have been expressed already about excesses in what's going on in Asia. They're quite important, but there's more than just cyclical dynamics at work in those trends, and so they are worthy of some discussion today, even though we can't fully do them justice. So what I'd like to do is to talk first about the North Atlantic region, then about the Asian region, make a few observations about those two regions and the differences, and then talk a little bit about Australia towards the end. Well, the group of countries that you could label as North Atlantic, quote-unquote, by which I mean North America, the UK, continental Europe, are in the early phase of a recovery from a rather deep downturn. For several of these countries, the downturn was the worst seen in decades. In other cases, the downturn was serious, but no more serious than the ones in the mid-70s or early 1980s. But what's been unusual, actually, in this episode is not so much the depth of the recessions, it's been the slowness of the recovery. For most of the business cycles in the second half of the 20th century, the typical experience was that a sharp downturn was followed usually by a pretty sharp upswing. That wasn't universally true, but by and large, that relationship tended to hold. In this episode, it's been quite different, of course. The downturn has been followed by a very slow, very gradual upswing so far. Let me show you the only picture I'm going to show today, which is, and this is a chart or a table of real GDP compared to its pre-crisis peak and the rate of unemployment compared to its pre-crisis low point. And you can see that in the case of the United States, the level of GDP is now back to the previous peak, but that took 3 years to occur. In the UK and in a number of other countries in Europe, output remains below the pre-crisis peak, in some cases quite a long way below, including in the UK here. And of course, in some countries in Europe, the contraction is in fact still continuing. So GDP is getting further below that previous peak as time goes by. A corollary of this is that the rate of unemployment remains considerably elevated in many countries relative to the pre-crisis low point, and that's what's shown in the right-hand channel, right-hand column of the table. And just to note, for future reference, the positive, rather large positive numbers for many of the countries in Asia, and Australia, quite a nice, modest, steady positive there on GDP as well. So having shown you that, in order for you not to get too distracted, I'll just turn it off for a little while, bring it back later. So far in the North Atlantic, Europe, North America, UK, recovery's been rather modest. In a way, that isn't that surprising because it's related to the nature of the downturn. Unusually, for rich countries in the past 50 years at least, the downturn was, of course, associated with serious and widespread financial distress. And history shows that recoveries from downturns that are characterised like that tend to be rather slow, drawn-out affairs. We need think no further, actually, than Japan's experience over the past nearly 20 years now to see that. But in fact, there's a fair bit of research that shows that that's the case more generally. Moreover, while banking systems are in the process of regaining health, that's not yet completed, and nor is it clear in many of these countries that households are finished with the process of reducing their leverage and strengthening their own balance sheet. So these are headwinds for major countries. There are now some signs as well that some other factors may be something of a headwind for recovery in a number of the major countries in the period ahead. And one of those is the state of government budgets. These have left a number of countries with the feeling that they really face no choice but to embark on a path of fiscal contraction, if not now, very soon. Now, in approximate sense, of course, the rather difficult state of public finances in a number of countries is due to the financial crisis itself. Not so much the bank rescue packages as simply the impact on revenues and spending of a long and protracted downturn. Ideally, of course, you want the public budget to swing into deficit as a device to cushion the economy in an environment where the economy's gone into a downturn itself. So you actually want to allow the government budget to go to deficit as a cushion. But that ideal, of course, assumes that the government's own accounts are in such a position that allowing that period of temporary deficit does not call into question the solvency of the state itself. The problem is that in a number of countries, and especially this is true in Europe, a large burden of general spending, significant debt burdens as a consequence of past deficits, underfunded pension systems, and unfavourable demographics have been on a collision course for a long time, and that collision has become much more imminent as a result of the financial crisis. What the crisis has done, in fact, is to bring the moment of truth closer. In the euro area as well, the intersection of banking and fiscal issues, as we know, including the exposures of the banks themselves to the sovereigns of Europe, is heightening the difficulty. So although Europe has a highly developed single monetary policy framework, the frameworks for other arms of financial policy have not been as well developed. That's now a work in progress and things are being done to address that, but that takes time and it's a very complex issue. And at heart there, really, the heart of that issue is the question of the incidence across the taxpayers of Europe of the costs in various kinds of fixing the European banking problems. So that's the North Atlantic picture. The contrast between that story and the one for Asia, in all frankness, could really hardly be more stark. Most of the countries in Asia have had a V-shaped recovery. Of course, that's been led by China and India, as I said, where real GDP is 20% or more higher than its preceding peak. In fact, these countries didn't actually have a decline in GDP. They slowed down, but didn't actually have a significant contraction to speak of. A range of other countries have had a pretty strong upswing as well. Japan's an exception, of course, to this. But then again, the story with Japan is that after the bubble period, which is 20 years ago now, and if you combine the recovery or the attempted recovery from that, which is very difficult at the best of times, and you add declining population and generally very low returns on capital in that country, well, Japan is much less a source of dynamism for the global economy now than it used to be. But in truth, I think the world economy, in fact, has gotten used to that, and the focus is now on some of the others in this table. So how is it that the story in Asia is so different to the story for the North Atlantic countries? Well, the first important factor is, of course, that Asia didn't really have a banking crisis to speak of. In fact, and this is perhaps not as well recognised in this part of the world as perhaps it should be, most countries in the world haven't had a banking crisis in the past several years. It's certainly true that the extraordinary events of September and October 2008, by putting enormous pressure on markets, that affected adversely banks everywhere. But most banks in Asia, or Latin America, or for that matter Australia, in the past few years have generally not had unusually bad losses on loans. And they had not been very much involved in the holdings in securities of complex structured type that have done so much damage to the balance sheets of so many of the world's major institutions. In the Asian region, by and large, governments have not needed to end up recapitalising their banks, unlike, of course, the case in so many of the major jurisdictions. So that is a key difference with the North Atlantic countries. A second factor is that the countries of Asia had ample scope for stimulatory macroeconomic policies in the face of the crisis, and they used that scope. The Chinese fiscal stimulus in particular was probably one of the biggest, if not the biggest, around the world. And that's made a big difference around Asia. Now, some people argue that the manner in which that was done has brought other problems, and that may be. But there's little doubt that those measures and the ones taken in a number of other countries at the time were effective in boosting demand when that was needed in the early part of 2009. Of course, the fact that there was scope to use fiscal policy this way in Asia reflects a long period, or it's the legacy of a long period, of impressive fiscal discipline around that region. That discipline is reinforced by Asian habits of saving in the general population. And it's also helped by the fact that the inherent growth dynamics of these countries are so strong, which has to make fiscal policy management inherently much easier. There's been another factor at work as well around the Asian region and also in South America, which has been an expansionary force, but which is increasingly starting to be seen as not quite so benign, and that's the fact that monetary policy has been quite accommodative. And then if you think about the better state of banking systems in Asia, and that's the channel through which accommodative monetary policies generally get transmitted to the economy, it's been much more effective than expansionary monetary policy has been in the major countries. And that's a result of the fact that, of course, the banking systems didn't have a crisis in the way some others did. Well, the issue recently here has started to be that these very accommodative conditions have been starting to look out of place, given the very robust growth in output, rising asset values, and increasingly rising overall goods and services inflation. And so a number of countries in the emerging Asian group, and particularly India and China, have been tightening policies of late in order to address this situation, and some of the Latin American countries have done likewise. Life is complicated for these countries by the fact that with the extremely ultra-low interest rates in the major countries, you get capital flows, you get pressure on exchange rates and so on, and that's difficult for the emerging world to deal with. And indeed, I think handling the difference in monetary policy settings in the emerging world and the advanced world, the resulting capital flows, the pressure on commodity prices and so on that this is all producing is one of the key issues for this year. Well, these trends I've described are all important manifestations of the fact that different regions are at different points in recovery from the downturn. But as I said at the beginning, this is not only a cyclical matter. The contrast between the performances of the key emerging countries and those of the older industrial countries in the past few years is in fact seeing a marked acceleration in the shift in the world economy's centre of gravity to the east, or if you're living in North America, to the west. That is towards Asia. This is a trend been going on quite a while, but it's sped up recently because of these differences in performance over the past few years. Since the beginning of 2008, non-Japan Asia, on our sums, has accounted for about 70% of the growth in global GDP. That's measured on a purchasing power basis the way the IMF does. It's also, and this is not as widely understood, it's also accounted, that region, for about 70% of the growth in global demand over the same period. In the period from 2000 to 2007, emerging Asia accounted for only 30% of global demand growth. So there's been quite a change there in that performance. We often hear from people in advanced countries that what we need is more demand in Asia. Well, there may be a sense in which saving rates in Asia were, in some sense, too high, and those in some industrial countries too low. But it isn't at all clear right at the moment that we need even faster growth in demand in Asia than what we've been seeing. After all, global GDP growth at 5%, that's plenty strong enough. And we're observing that prices for a whole range of raw materials, and these are the prices most responsive to demand in the short term, have been rising. So just at the moment, from a global point of view, what we need is not so much even more demand growth in the emerging world. What we actually need is a way of supplying more of Asia's demand growth from the parts of the world where spare capacity remains so large, that is principally in the North Atlantic countries. And of course that goes to issues of exchange rates, among other things, and those matters are highly relevant. But looking beyond the short term, there are some other things to talk about. There's a secular increase in living standards, of course, going on in the emerging world, and there are very large changes in the pattern of consumption that are accompanying that. Energy intensity is rising very quickly with income. The steel intensity of production has gone up a lot. It's already, in fact, quite high in China, probably won't rise much more. But if China is going to keep growing at 7% a year, which is their new target for quite a long time, there'll be strong growth in demand for the components of steel, which, of course, Australia sells a lot of, coal and iron ore. So steel consumption there will probably continue to rise quite a lot for some years yet. In India, steel intensity is, in fact, quite low and quite likely will rise a lot over the years ahead. In many developing countries, higher living standards are also prompting changes to diet, so the protein content of diet is going up a lot, and that has major implications for the demand for grains to feed the animals that people eat. You need a lot more grain to produce beef than you need if the humans are consuming just the grain. So these things are quite important, and it's not that surprising that rapid growth, not just cyclical growth, but secular growth around Asia and elsewhere, is putting upward pressure on prices for foodstuffs, energy and minerals. It may be that there's some speculative demand adding to that at the margin, but the speculators can't hold the prices up indefinitely. These big changes in prices, which seem to be rather long-running, surely are mainly a result of powerful but rather durable fundamental forces. The thing that is new, of course, is that this demand that's putting pressure upward pressure on prices is not demand coming by and large from the advanced world. By and large, it's not the story that you would have heard only a few years ago of OECD industrial output picking up and that putting upward pressure on prices for raw materials and commodities. The action, it is demand, but the action isn't so far in the major industrial countries. Prices are under upward pressure because of the demand coming from a couple of billion people in Asia who are seeking a way of life and who are rapidly achieving a way of life that we in the advanced countries have enjoyed for 50 years. Well, these sorts of price rises that we're seeing, not to mention the ones in oil as a result of the very recent events in North Africa, are actually unhelpful for the advanced economies, particularly the ones where the recovery has been hesitant so far. They'll also be very unwelcome for very poor countries whose people spend a large proportion of their income on food. For practical purposes, what's happening, in fact, presents to the advanced countries as a supply shock. Someone else's demand has pushed up the prices at which the market is prepared to supply raw materials and energy and agricultural commodities. So that's going to make it harder, really, at the margin to engender ongoing recovery in the advanced world. Moreover, if demand in the advanced countries did start to speed up more, and that presumably is the intention of the policies in those countries at the moment, then these price pressures will, in fact, get worse, unless there's either a significant slowdown in demand from the emerging world or a substantial new capacity to supply the relevant commodities comes on stream. Well, as it happens, everyone from Australia knows that a lot of new capacity is being planned for certainly some resource commodities, particularly the ones that we supply. Just to give you a figure or two, Australia ships about 1 million tonnes a day of iron ore. That will be 2 million within 4 or 5 years. There is a significant expansion in coal capacity as well. Natural gas, there's going to be a very large build-up in our capacity to supply that. We're not the only country doing this either. Quite substantial capacity expansions no doubt will occur in a number of the other commodity-supplying countries. So that will presumably help to contain demand-led pressure on prices over time. In the case of food, the story is slightly different, where, and I'm not an expert here, but the growth in supply of grains and so on over the medium term has to come from stronger productivity gains or more intensive farming. And my understanding is that the experts here are assuming that productivity growth in agriculture actually speeds up noticeably from the productivity that we've seen over the last 20 years or so. So I'm not sure where all that will pan out, but one thing is for certain, and that is that the rise of Asia, and we could probably add together here the major countries of Latin America as well, is changing the shape of the global economy quite profoundly, and it's altering the set of relative prices that we see in the global economy. And that process seems to be happening faster, I think, than most of us had generally assumed until recently. Let me say then a little bit about Australia before I finish. Well, we sit in an interesting position here. Like our Asian neighbours, we were affected by the events of late 2008. But the downturn was relatively brief. We were in a position to apply a liberal dose of policy stimulus to the economy, and we did, and that was done quite promptly. The banks remained in good shape, and they still are in good shape today. And so a recovery in Australia began in the first half of 2009. There's no question, of course, that the strength of China and Asia generally has been a significant boost for us. As in other developed countries, our consumers are feeling the effects of higher commodity prices as a reduction in their real income. But since Australia is also a producer of these commodities, the big rise in demand for energy, resources and food is expansionary for the economy overall. In fact, as I've been saying ad nauseam for a long time now, our terms of trade measured on a five-year moving average basis are at their highest level since Federation, or even longer. And so these events, in fact, are potentially very expansionary indeed for Australia, and a historically very large increase in investment in the resource sector is already underway and has quite a long way yet to run, as best we can tell. Well, just now, Australia is experiencing, I would say, growth close to trend, an unemployment rate of 5%, and an inflation rate in the twos, which is right where we want it. So in comparison with our experience over the preceding three or four decades, in fact, that's a pretty good combination. Looking ahead, our job is to manage this terms of trade episode and the associated investment boom, and we know that when we look back, historically, on other occasions where the global economy has conferred on Australia a significant gain in income, we have not often managed that very well. So on this occasion, we have to do better. We have to take opportunity to capitalise effectively on these very powerful trends in the world economy to which we are almost uniquely favourably exposed. We have a few things working in our favour, I think. One of them, one of the most important ones, is that the exchange rate is playing a role which it was never allowed to play in previous events of this kind. That is, it's responding to the rise in the terms of trade in a way that helps the economy absorb this income without overheating. Another thing that, at least at present, we have that's assisting is that households have become noticeably more careful than they were in their attitude to spending and borrowing. We're seeing rates of saving among our households that we haven't seen for 20 years or more. And at least initially, as we face a significant rise in national income, that's helpful. Of course, households in a number of countries, including this one, are doing the same. They're saving more, consolidating balance sheets and so on. In Australia, our good fortune is that we're doing that against the backdrop of a surge in income, whereas other countries are doing it against the backdrop of income weakness. So we're now in Australia engaged in a national discussion about how to stretch the benefits of the resources boom over a long period and how to manage the risks that it will bring. These are very complex matters, and they will involve a very wide range of policy areas: macroeconomic, microeconomic, tax, industrial, and so on. But if we can conduct that discussion in a mature fashion, and if we can follow that mature discussion up with sensible policies, then we have a good chance of leaving to the next generation a wealthier, more secure, and more stable Australian economy. Thank you very much for your attention. That's fine.
Thank you, Governor, for your comments. I'll hand my hand tonight to the media and the
What industries will save the country beyond the boom? All of them, most likely, would be the answer. No one knows, in truth, how this episode will play out. We know that, and I gave a speech recently on this, we know that previous episodes where the terms of trade rose very steeply lasted long enough actually to be quite disruptive, and they were disruptive, but eventually they ended and things reversed. The argument that says that this one will run a long time is the argument that says that the Chinese emergence and the Indian emergence coming behind that have a long way to go, quite possibly decades, not just years, and that as a result of that there's a fundamental change in the relative price and the demand for certain things that Australia happens to be endowed with. The argument in the other direction is simply that in history all booms end, and you should think about the likelihood that we'll at some point see lower prices than the ones we do today, and we certainly in the RBA assume that. The truth is that you can't know exactly how this will turn out, so the key is going to be, I think, to be prudent, careful, which is why I argue for saving a lot of the additional income for the time being until it gets clearer how permanent it is. And I think it will also involve, keeping our economy as flexible and able to adjust to change as much as we can. And there's a whole range of policy things, of course, that will feed into that. So the answer is we don't know. We can't know. So we have to plan on the basis that we can't know and that there's uncertainty and be suitably prudent as a result.
House prices have been rising for a long time now. We haven't had a bust yet, but do you ever lie awake at night sort of worrying about it at all?
I worry about a lot of things at night, James.
But housing in particular.
Let's establish a few facts. Actually, for the past year or two, house prices haven't done anything much at all. They're up in some parts of the country, down in others. Interestingly enough, the two regions where house prices have been weakest, Queensland and WA, given the nature of the resources boom that's building up, it's hard to believe that they're going to see chronic weakness over a long time. I think the story for recent weakness is probably that they've got some indigestion as a result of the previous upswing. But as we see that unfold, we continue to see arrears rates on mortgages very low by global standards, 50 or 60 basis points. So I'm not terribly troubled by... I don't think we have huge rises going on. We don't have a gearing up going on now. We've got quite modest growth in housing credit now for the past year or more. That all seems to me to be consistent with a household sector that's being more careful. It's probably observed what's happened in some other places in the world and thought, let's not have that, and people are being more careful as a result, and of course we do have a surge in income happening. So that's probably not top of my list of worries. I think there are significant issues to do with housing values, but I think they are as much social, really, as economic, and I won't go into that today, there's not time, but I think the other thing I'll say is that it's quite often quoted very high ratios of price to income for Australia, but if you get the broadest measures, countrywide price and a countrywide measure of income, the ratio is about 4.5, and it hasn't moved for much either way for 10 years. And that is higher than it used to be, but it's actually not exceptional by a global standard as far as I can see. Next question. So,
Andrew Fraser, advisor to Mitsubishi Corporation. Governor, you spoke about the problems of lack of demand in the North Atlantic area. Were you to be asked by your colleagues in the central banks in that region whether their first priority should be debt reduction or accentuating growth in their economies. How would you respond? And I think all my fellow guests will respect your confidence on this reply.
I'm tempted to answer the question by saying I'd say, good luck, guys. It's a very difficult situation because, as you say, countries have significant debt issues, and there's no doubt that that has to be addressed over time. But you don't want to derail the still, you know, early stage of an upswing that is badly needed. And in fact, you don't want to make the fiscal position worse by aborting the upswing early. So it's a difficult situation. I think the thing that most people would say would be it's okay to be running significant deficits now, but have a credible plan for return to balance and so on, and handling the debt over time. And that's by and large what most countries, I think, are seeking to do, isn't it? The difficulty is that some of them have better starting points than others, but you know, that's the way it is. And as I say, I haven't, I've said this many times, I haven't yet found a counterpart with whom I would like to swap problems at this point. Certainly not that one.